This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, journalist Michael Scott Moore talks about his research into the relationship between piracy and human trafficking.
An abductee himself by Somalian pirates in 2012, Michael returned to the waters off the shores of Libya to participate in another rescue effort.
Approximately 10 million Americans are victims of so-called revenge porn, and it hasn't been easy to get relief in the legal system. Attorney and author Carrie Goldberg is changing that with her law practice and her new book titled Nobody's Victim, Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
In 2012, journalist Michael Scott Moore went to Somalia to research a book on piracy. He was abducted by a gang of Somali pirates who demanded $20 million from the U.S. government for his release. After protracted negotiations and a payment of $1.6 million, Michael was finally released 2.5 years later. His international bestseller, The Desert and the Sea, chronicles his 977 days in captivity. More than a decade later, this past February, two men were convicted in federal court for helping to carry out his kidnapping. On April 1st, Michael sailed with a German rescue ship, the Humanity One, to write about migration across the central Mediterranean. In a piece recently published in Foreign Policy, Michael makes a connection between human trafficking and migration, asylum seeking, and pirating. We're delighted to speak with Michael Scott Moore about his observations on pirating and human smuggling. In addition to The Desert and the Sea, he has written the highly acclaimed book Sweetness in Blood about the history of surfing. He serves on the board of Hostage US, an organization that supports American hostages and their families.
Michael, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
You write about record numbers during the mass migration of refugees in unstable rafts from such countries as Afghanistan and Syria. From your perspective, what are the reasons for the uptick in these numbers?
Well, it's hard to say, but there are more people coming across the Mediterranean this year than there have been since 2017. And in some of the months this year, it's been a fourfold difference over last year. The one very big reason would be sort of very public racism in Tunisia that drives people out of Tunisia. But I was on a rescue boat off the coast of Libya, and I think there's simply a backlog of refugees in the camps in Libya, and that combined with very good weather right now in the Mediterranean probably accounts for the numbers.
Michael, what is the cost, both financially and in the human toll, of these refugees?
Financially, it's hard to say. I mean, of course, once they're rescued and once they're taken on, that in any new country, that costs a lot of money. But the cost for the refugees to get to where they're going is also enormous. They pay fees to smugglers to get across land in Africa, and then once they're in Libya, they stay put for a while until they can raise money, normally from their families, to cross the Mediterranean. So there are a number of fees along the way that the smugglers demand that amount to a hostage ransom.
You mentioned Libya. In your article, you describe how these refugees in their makeshift rafts are met by the so-called Libyan Coast Guard. Tell us a little bit about this Libyan Coast Guard, and why are they referred to as so-called Libyan Coast Guard?
Yeah, that was the eye-opening thing on this trip for me. I had read about the Libyan Coast Guard and how it was corrupt and not quite even an official government organization, because there are two governments in Libya at the very least. There's a civil war going on. And the Libyan, what's called the Libyan Coast Guard, is actually a collection of men on boats that are behaving like the Coast Guard a little bit, but they're connected to militias on land, which are also connected to the smugglers. So it's an exaggeration to say that they're really behaving like a normal Coast Guard in a politically stable country. They do go out and intercept these rafts full of migrants, but it's wildly wrong to say that they would be somehow suppressing smuggling, because what I found out is that they, in effect, act like a long arm of the smugglers. They tend to bring smugglers back to land where they suffer again and try to get out. In other words, they pay a second fee to try to get out on the water.
7 years ago, the European Union vowed to stop human smuggling by funding this Libyan Coast Guard. Can you talk about the dynamic between charitable organizations or NGOs who are trying to help refugees and the Coast Guard?
Yeah, I was on an NGO ship, because right now it's just private or civilian rescue missions that are out on the water, with the exception of the Italian Coast Guard. Yeah, in 2017, the EU thought it would be a good idea to fund and build up the Libyan Coast Guard to suppress smuggling. But as a matter of practice, when you're out there on an NGO ship, the Libyan Coast Guard ships are belligerent, and we even listened in on their radio frequency. One of their ships coming up to ours, which is painted brightly as in, you know, it's called SOS Humanity, the ship or the organization, and it's obvious what the ship is. And they approached us and they said in Arabic, we had an Arabic translator, they said, "It is the organization of our enemy." And there wouldn't seem to be any need for that if everyone is truly trying to suppress smuggling and or save lives. But the Coast Guard out there is acting like they have a vested interest in doing the very opposite of what the NGOs are doing.
So within that framework and how you described the Coast Guard as in reality being the long arm of the smugglers, and you go into quite a bit of detail about that in your foreign policy article, and you wrote in the article, the persons going out as the Libyan Coast Guard are either directly in cooperation with the persons that put the migrant boats on the water or have connections with these persons through the black market. And does that factor in to what you're talking about here and what you've said about the pirate business model's similarity to the human smuggling model?
Yeah, what you mentioned there was a direct quote from the captain of our NGO ship. So he's used to this. He goes out all the time, and he's used to the Libyan Coast Guard. And so he was telling me how things looked even before I saw any of those ships. And it's shocking, because the smugglers on land, they do behave like Somali pirates. And I had an inkling of that when I first got out of Somalia back in 2014. Of course, the first big wave, the one that everyone thinks of immigrants to Europe across the Mediterranean was happening right around then in 2015 and 2016. And I wrote a different article at the time. I got to know the issues then, but one thing I noticed was that a Somali fleeing Somalia came across the Mediterranean, and he said he was stopped in the middle by smugglers driving SUVs carrying Kalashnikovs who fed him nothing but biscuits and mango juice. And that rang a bell, because that was a very common food that I got fed by the Somali pirates. But it occurred to me, never mind whether there was a real connection with the food, that the business model was the same. And that turns out to be true. These guys make sure that refugees get only so far, and then they put them on the phone with their families, and they say, we need more money to move so-and-so a little bit further, or this person needs more money to get onto a boat on the Mediterranean. It becomes a human trafficking model that's not so different from hostage taking.
Michael, would you mind talking a little bit about your own experience for listeners who may not be familiar with it?
Yeah, of course. I was held hostage for 2 years and 8 months in Somalia, something like 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I was in the middle of that ordeal. And I was captured in 2012 while writing an article and hopefully a book about Somali pirates on the ground in Somalia. And I was captured on land
but by a pirate gang, and they eventually put me on board a ship they had hijacked. So I had a pretty good inside look at how pirates operate, and I saw how they treated the many Asian fishermen on board that ship. So I didn't get out until the fall of 2014, 2 years and 8 months later. So it was a serious ordeal, and I noticed, like I said, that there were not just connections between the pirates and human traffickers, but also a parallel between those business models. And that's what was interesting to me when I went out on the Mediterranean this time.
Ben Parker, who's a longtime reporter on the humanitarian aid sector, has said that there's a general lack of checks and balances in relief and in aid. Do you think that international aid factors into the human smuggling and/or the piracy equation?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think that he's right. There's a lack of checks and balances, and that means that some rescue NGOs, like the one that I sailed with in the Mediterranean, are better than others. I happen to sail with a very organized one. They were very good. I've heard stories about others. So it's not a controlled space necessarily. But I would say that the aid relationship between poor countries and rich countries can also be disastrous. It can be helpful, but it can also get dependent and dysfunctional very quickly. So that can sometimes worsen the conditions in the countries where some of these people are fleeing from. The grand example is from Somalia. So the UN was sending grain shipments directly to Somalia around the time that the president was about to collapse. He was a Gaddafi-like figure in Somalia at the time. Civil war was about to break out, and the factions that were starting to form in Mogadishu were arguing about grain shipments. And one of them wanted to steer some to his people, and the UN wanted to control where they were going, and that led to the Battle of Mogadishu. That led to what's called Black Hawk Down. So that's a perfect example, and maybe the grandest example, of the complete failure of the international aid model. Because inevitably there's going to be strings attached, and inevitably the powerful countries are going to try to have their say. In that case, people died, and that's a really good example of how things can go wrong. That doesn't mean that wherever there's aid, there's poverty, but it can entrench poverty. It can become a dependent relationship. So that's just speaking very broadly.
Michael, how would you position piracy and human trafficking within the larger milieu of today's geopolitical and socioeconomic issues and refugee crises, especially within the context of what you just described for us?
Well, I think human trafficking has become more important and more lucrative. I'm not sure people realize that moving humans can be more profitable than moving drugs. And in fact, while I was in Somalia as a hostage, the importance of piracy sort of faded, because I think the pirate bosses were realizing it wasn't the most profitable way, the most efficient way to make a buck. So then because of what was happening with the Arab Spring in 2013, 2014, I think some of them actually moved into human smuggling and human trafficking because it was more reliable, and they had the basic infrastructure, which is SUVs and Kalashnikovs and cheap food. So I actually wrote an article back then about how at least one pirate boss had moved into human smuggling on the East African side of things. It doesn't mean that all pirates are traffickers, but there's a similarity in the business model. And right now, piracy has reduced over on that side of Africa. It's a worse problem off Nigeria right now, but off Somalia, it's not much of a problem anymore. But human trafficking in both hemispheres, I mean, coming up to the southern border of the United States, too, will continue to be a really big problem because it's such a good way for traffickers to make a living. And that's why I think any solution has to attack the traffickers' business model. In other words, it has to drain business from them.
Along those lines, what you're describing is the need for a strong commitment to resolving these crises with an eye toward what you've just described. And there is a noticeable lack of such a commitment. And this lack of public policy commitment to resolving these crises can be exemplified metaphorically by a recent notorious example as you know, and you mentioned in your article, the tragic drowning of hundreds of refugees off the coast of Greece, to which there was a minimal public response to that human tragedy just this past May. At the same time, contrast that with the overwhelming media coverage and expenditure of unlimited resources to find the Titan submarine and the deaths, tragic as it was, of five people. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, at least on social media, the difference was stark. And of course, the media about the little submersible was huge, partly because it was such an eccentric but also such an irresponsible story. I mean, the reasons for it were, I think, predictable by the diving community. I mean, in my experience, lots of people are out on the Mediterranean trying to rescue people. Not enough, but a lot. And I think the Greek story made more noise in Europe than it did in the United States. So in part, that was a difference that we saw on American social media. But it's absolutely true. I mean, poor people have been dying for years on the Mediterranean. And I think one problem with this story is that people are sick of it. They've grown too accustomed to it. The imbalance between the submersible story of five very rich people and these other stories. In the Greek tragedy, I think over 500 people, maybe not confirmed dead, but are still missing, so probably dead. You can't even compare. I want to say about that story, by the way, a lot of people blame the Greek Coast Guard, and they probably do bear some direct responsibility because they tried to tow that boat, and it didn't work, and it probably led to the capsizing of that boat. But the reason, the ultimate blame for that lies with the traffickers for putting that boat on the water in the first place. That was probably one of the more stable boats that goes out and aims for Europe. The one we rescued when I was on the NGO ship in April, the SOS Humanity, we rescued an inflatable raft stuffed with 70 people. I mean, there was no reason that boat should have been out 70 miles from Libya. I can't think of anyone I know who would have stepped foot on it.
What you've described on the one hand is the lack of attention publicly was devoted to what was going on to the refugees as opposed to this little submersible. But it's not just the lack of attention, but the disproportionate allocation of resources. Millions and millions of dollars went into trying to find this Titan submarine, and yet little or no effort was made. My understanding was that had they acted a little more quickly, that was also would have created a much more less tragic outcome.
The European Coast Guards and government organizations that could do something about that are also very sluggish about it. The one reason, I think, is that Europe thinks, you know, on a very superficial level, maybe popular opinion lets the government sort of behave as if supporting the Libyan Coast Guard is enough. You know, we're doing a lot over on that side of the Mediterranean, so we don't have to do so much on this side. That's false. I mean, it's so false, it's offensive, because the Libyan Coast Guard is doing the opposite of suppressing trafficking. It's to support the Libyan Coast Guard is to support human trafficking. And that's the worst part of the story to me. The fact is that there should be more rescues from the European side, but that's not a long-term solution. You know, and as long as you're pulling people out of the water and making sure they're safe and alive, you're not really affecting the trafficking on the Libyan side. You're sort of part of that trafficking route. I would encourage everyone to do that as long as people are still drowning, but it's not a long-term solution.
Michael, just going back for a second to the Libyan Coast Guard, I understand that Italy and the European Union give a lot of money to the Coast Guard. Is their goal ostensibly to reduce human trafficking, or is it to implement right-wing policies aimed at stopping migration and asylum seeking?
It's a very good question. Ostensible reason is to stop human trafficking, because in a normal situation, then that's what a Coast Guard would do in a functioning country. It's not pretty, but they can shut that stuff down. Especially with the new Italian government, there will be a right-wing political component to it. And sure, as long as it's shutting down immigration to, especially irregular immigration to Italy, then that right-wing government is not going to be bothered. They're going to be happy with the results. They were trying to slow down landings of rescued refugees while we were on the water, as a matter of fact. Once we had 70 people on board, first of all, we were not allowed to go get more people. It was one rescue at a time, and then we were assigned a very distant port. We had to sail from down near Libya all the way up to Ravenna, which is close to Venice. It was a five-day ride on our ship. That was an intentional policy by the new far-right Italian government to slow down the migrant landings. Yes, those governments will absolutely do what they can. And all you can say about the incredible support for the dysfunctional so-called Coast Guard in Libya is that it really, really doesn't help. It's counterproductive as far as tamping down trafficking.
So what I understand is that if not permitted to land in Italy or another European country, they are taken back to Libya.
The convention right now on the Mediterranean, a lot of this goes back to the Convention of the Law of the Sea, as opposed to which is effectively international law. What normally happens is if somebody's rescued, they go to the nearest safe port. Libya is not a safe port, so at least the Western ships don't take them back to Libya. Once people have landed in Europe and they're processed normally by the Italians, it's Italy that takes the brunt of this, because there's a lack of EU coordination, you know, to receive refugees. Just over 50% of the people who come through this means win asylum. So half the people aren't even eligible, and then technically they're supposed to return to their home countries. Technically they should be flown back, but that's a dysfunctional system too, and a lot of them go underground. No one is really doing very much to solve the supposed problem that everyone sees. I argue in my piece in Foreign Policy that it would make a lot more sense to set up a structure under the UN where people in very serious crisis hit countries that have serious asylum claims can make those claims from abroad and then simply get flown to Europe. We've been doing that in the United States since the end of the Vietnam War. The boat people crisis on the Gulf of Thailand in the late 70s was very similar to this, and a sort of long-distance asylum application system, which is still in use, by the way, was the answer. So Europe could take a page out of that playbook.
What is the so-called distant port policy, and what's the problem with that?
Right. The distant port policy was a fairly new policy when I was on the water with SOS Humanity in April. It's an intentional policy by the new Italian government to slow down migrant landings and to slow down asylum claims by people who've been rescued out of the water. So when we got the 70 people off the raft one night in April, we had to turn almost immediately for Italy. And we were assigned a port. You know, the Italian government can say, we want you to land here and not there. And they had started to deliberately assign distant ports, which the leaders of SOS Humanity objected to strenuously. And in fact, I think they mounted a lawsuit. Because it took us 5 days to sail from that part of the Mediterranean up to Ravenna in northern Italy, which was a sympathetic port. I think that was not a bad town to land in. But it kept our ship off the water for more days during spring season, you know, during that particular rotation. I think it's a deliberate policy by the far-right Italian government. It's not justified as long as people are drowning. But these are the kinds of things that the NGOs have to deal with. These are the kinds of things that go on underreported.
Michael, our listeners will be fascinated with your stories and your life experience. Can you share with us a little bit what you're working on now?
Yes, I'm working on a new novel, and which is about drones. I wrote the first two chapters of it when I was still a hostage in Somalia. But I'm also working on a few pieces of journalism, including one about the trial of two pirates in my case. So this stuff is still going on. And two pirates were before an American judge in New York in February. They were found guilty, and they'll be sentenced in the fall and I hope to have an essay about that coming out right around then. We'll see. I have to wait for the sentencing and then finish it up, but that's what I'm working on right now.
Yes, and we should just underscore that these two pirates were found guilty early this year of aiding in your case.
Yes, exactly. No, they were absolutely involved in my case. And I also want to add that there's a story, this came up during the trial too. There's a story that a lot of people still believe that pirates are just frustrated fishermen in Somalia. That fisherman story was true in the 1990s, but by the time we were hearing about Somali pirates, in other words, by the time they were making headlines for hijacking tankers and other big cargo ships, they were already part of an organized criminal organization, because you cannot do that even on little skiffs without top-down finance. So they needed people who were bosses, and they needed people who were like foot soldiers on the water. And all that plays into the trial. I mean, neither one of these guys is a, you know, one-time frustrated fisherman or anything like that.
I hope, although the resolution of the criminal trial is not going to bring closure or resolution to the crises that we are involved in, that you are involved in documenting, but I hope that it brings some closure for you personally.
Thank you. I think arguing with the defense lawyers really helped me personally. As for the other stuff, no, there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, a lot of work.
And Michael, I want to add that in this time of corporate media, you've really given new meaning to investigative reporting, for which we are very thankful. Your work is so important.
Thank you so much.
Can you tell our listeners how they can follow you?
Yes, absolutely. I do have a Twitter feed, Michael Scott Moore. You can find my name. And I also have a website at radiofreemike.net. which will take you to my Twitter and Instagram feeds. Twitter is where I'm the most political. Everything else is a little bit frivolous.
Well, we'll look for you both frivolous and of consequence. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In January 2019, New York State passed a bill to outlaw revenge porn, joining 41 other states that have passed similar laws. Revenge porn is the term for the non-consensual sharing on the internet of sexually explicit photos or videos. Victims say it can be as damaging as any other form of abuse, but without the same legal protections. Private images can follow victims around for years, turning up when employers or romantic partners search for their names on the internet. But in New York, victims have experienced years of helplessness in the courts. Prosecutors could not charge offenders for a practice that was not illegal, and judges turned down appeals for help on the grounds of free speech, even as other states were enacting protections. Under New York's new law, offenders can be punished for up to 1 year in jail. The law also allows victims to sue the person who shared the revenge porn, which about a dozen other states also allow. Most people have heard about high-profile instances of sexual images used as blackmail or revenge, involving the rich and famous, such as singer Rihanna or actor Jennifer Lawrence. But this affects millions of people, from middle school students to Marines, and as many as 10 million Americans have been victims of revenge porn. Joining us today is New York attorney Carrie Goldberg. Herself a victim of revenge porn, she started a law firm in the city to focus on defending victims of the practice. She has just come out with her new book, Nobody's Victim: Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. Attorney Carrie Goldberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I am very happy to be here.
Well, congratulations on your book, Nobody's Victim: Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I want to ask you first, how do you define revenge porn?
Well, revenge porn is the non-consensual distribution of sexually graphic images and videos. So it's kind of a colloquial term that was picked up by the media, but revenge isn't really a necessary requirement. People and our clients, we represent many victims of non-consensual porn, which is what we call it in the office. And there, you know, we have some clients who, yes, you know, a jilted ex-boyfriend posted images of them, sexual images, to the internet and to websites for revenge. But in other cases, you know, our clients are young girls who maybe pictures of them are passed around school, you know, for the entertainment of their peers. Or we represent celebrities whose pictures have gone viral, not because there was necessarily malicious intention in doing that, but just because, you know, the offenders were, you know, hacked in or were getting paid or all sorts of other non-revenge reasons.
Now, how does this relate to stalking? Are they separate? Are they related?
So stalking is, it's a course of conduct that results in somebody fearing for their life. So oftentimes, revenge porn is one tactic that stalkers take, especially when stalking occurs after the end of a relationship. We've had cases where a stalker might start by posting naked images of his ex on the internet, and then his dangerous behavior escalates to the point, in one of our cases, where he was impersonating our client and making bomb threats to Jewish community centers all over the country. It's one of many traits that we see commonly in stalking. We rarely see cases of stalking that don't involve the exploitation of the internet.
Now, what do you say to critics who, and I think I read this recently in the New York Times letter section, say, well, you shouldn't have taken naked photos. What do you expect? Do you get that a lot?
I do, and I used to, when I first started my firm in 2014, before people even knew that there was this injury of spreading people's most humiliating moments online. And over the years, we get that less and less because our country and a lot of the world, and I think the UK, they've passed legislation to criminalize revenge porn. And so when our law enforcers and our laws step in to say, hey, this behavior is so bad that we're actually going to be regulating it with our criminal laws, then it kind of shows that it's time to stop blaming victims. We wouldn't blame a victim of a robbery for, you know, that's what you get for having a home. Your possessions were stolen, so that's what you get for having, you know, that nice TV and artwork. We can't be blaming victims. And that's also very important when we think about the way that the humiliation type of crimes have been evolving, where we now have deep fakes, which is kind of like synthetic porn, where I can use AI to manipulate porn videos so that it looks like your head is actually on the porn actress's body. And that, you know, so anybody actually can become a victim regardless of whether they've taken pictures and shared them.
Good point. And the viewing audience does not know that.
Exactly. And I think it also just comes down to basic consent. You know, consenting to share images with one person in context of an intimate relationship is not consenting for them to share it with the rest of the world. And we, you know, it's 2019, and we do everything with our phone and everything with the internet. It's how we shop. It's how we date. It's how we communicate with our loved ones. It's how we set up appointments. So, of course, it's going to be how we mate and date and express, you know, intimacy. So there's nothing perverse or obscene about you know, just the basic of taking a naked picture. It's what's obscene is sharing it without the consent of the depicted person.
One study that I read estimates that up to 10 million Americans have been victims of revenge porn. Why don't we hear more about this? It's clearly an epidemic.
That's a great question. I hear a lot about it because that's what my law practice is devoted to. It's all people who've been sexually dominated and whether online or offline. You know, I maybe have a little bit of a different perspective because I'm constantly dealing with it. But one of the purposes of my book is for people to know that it's a thing, and for people in the UK, in the US, and anywhere else to realize that there is this domination of other people not just through physical domination, but also through manipulation via tech.
Psychological online manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, is there
a profile, Carrie, of a typical offender? I understand that a large number are indeed men dominating women.
So, in the book, I mean, one of its purposes is to kind of demystify the offenders, because we deal with so many different kinds of offenses, and all of our clients are people who've been attacked or are under attack. We see these character behaviors of the offenders emerge over and over again. And so we've created this taxonomy of offenders, and we have a-holes, psychos, pervs, and trolls. And each of those categories has kind of a different set of behavioral traits. And it's almost as if they have a playbook for it. The a-holes are people who are acting maliciously but have a certain level of self-control and can be stopped, at least with an order of protection or a cease and desist letter. The psycho is somebody who is engaging in stalking behavior that we've had no success in stopping without the intervention of criminal law enforcement. And pervs are people who are dominating and preying on our clients sexually, whether that's through sextortion or through offline sexual assault. And then the trolls, the remaining category, are people who mainly are aggressing online. So they might be the people that are organizing through 8chan to all gang up on a feminist reporter, for instance.
Carrie, in the book, you very honestly talk about your own experience and how you were propelled really to take control, take action. You formed your own law firm. Would you mind sharing a little bit about your experience for our listening audience?
Yes, I will talk a little bit about that. In 2013, the beginning of 2013, I was kind of I fell into this whirlwind romance with somebody, and he just kind of knocked me off my feet. And after a couple weeks, it kind of became, it went from, oh my gosh, you know, I found somebody who's obsessed with me, to, oh my gosh, this man's obsessed with me. And he was immediately really controlling and scary and jealous and would gaslight me. And when I, after a couple months, when I tried to get out of the relationship, he just went on this scorched earth attack on me. threatening to send pictures, intimate pictures of me to my colleagues and my boss. And then he would actually email me those pictures and say those people were blind copied. He reached out to like 16 of my friends and family members and spread lies to them about me having STDs and being pregnant and a drug addict. He made false police reports and I got arrested, and then he was making all these threats to the point that I moved out of my home. And it was just nothing in my life was the same. I tried to get the police involved, and they told me to go to family court. When I went to family court, they told me that he had a First Amendment right to do a lot of the behavior that he was doing. And I had so much trouble finding anybody who could help me. I, you know, had the advice of a couple lawyers, but this was like nothing they'd ever seen before. And so when my ordeal was over, when the bogus criminal case against me were dropped and he pled guilty to criminal charges and I got an order of protection, I left my job. I was already a lawyer, but I was working with elderly people. And I started my law firm, and that was in January of 2014, about a year after I began the relationship with him. And my whole purpose is basically to become the lawyer that I'd needed. And, you know, now we, you know, it's really rewarding to have somebody come to us when they're in sort of their storm of hellishness, and they think that they're the only person that's ever gone through anything like that, like this, and they're terrified. And it's really great to be able to say, we know what to do. We've seen this kind of behavior, and this is what works to stop it. Or we have these relationships with law enforcers who will, you know, who are really good at the forensic evidence analysis that we'll need to get him arrested. You know, to have all the connections and to not be having to, like, learn what to do, as my lawyers had to do when I was dealing with it.
In your book, you reference an excitement that you had when your clients reached a point where they switched from being a victim to getting angry and wanting to take action, which relates obviously to the title of your book, Nobody's Victim, and Fighting Back. Does that happen with most of the clients that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important trait to the client experience, because it's not easy to go through not just the stalking, but also the procedure of getting legal relief. And it's really important to me that not, you know, that the procedure of getting help is not a nightmare for a client. And so if I can, you know, help them reframe it as, okay, you are now a warrior. You're done being a, you know, like, let's convert you from being a victim to a warrior. And now we have this legal challenge together to go through the bureaucracy and the morass of the legal system. And that's going to be part of the challenge now. And you have a little army of lawyers that are here to help you. It can actually, you know, it can be a really rewarding fight when we are embarking on some of the lengthier cases. I mean, we have some cases where it's all about getting the content off the internet, or, you know, there's not as much activity for the client. But if it's a big litigation, you know, I want to make sure that they're in it for the fight and that they're angry and that they're propelled, because that's what will keep them motivated, because they're leaders. There aren't that many victims that will, you know, take action. And so I want them to see themselves as pioneers.
New York State recently passed a law to protect victims of this kind of crime, joining what I understand is a majority of other states. Who opposed this law, Carrie?
We first introduced this law 5 years ago. At the time, New York could have been one of the like third or fourth states to criminalize non-consensual pornography. And for 5 years, our lawmakers did not vote in for this law. And in those 5 years, like almost like 40 states passed laws, and so New York finally became the 46th state. So it was a combination of our lawmakers not caring enough about sexual privacy, and then last year in 2018, when it was about to pass, our Senate got spooked by Google's lobbyists that came out of nowhere and did something to intimidate them on the last day of the session to not even vote on the bill. And so we are actually up against big tech. And they hide behind the lobbyists that they pay millions of dollars to so that they never have to deal with, I mean, until they met me, you know, that they never have to deal directly with these really kind of socially unpopular and misogynistic policies that they have. You know, just Google, for instance, is the cause of most people who've been the victims of revenge porn's harm. Their Google results are destroyed. You know, the first pages of their search engine results, when they type their name in, lead to revenge porn. That makes it really hard to get a job or a date or even a roommate. Nobody does anything without typing, you know, without checking somebody's Google results. And so then on top of that, for Google to oppose the criminal law safety measures available to victims, it's disgusting. And they need to be held, you know, accountable for what their lobbyists are doing.
How difficult, if I woke up one morning and saw a private photo on a Google search of myself, how hard is it for me to get that image removed? And how long does it take?
Well, so Google now has a quote-unquote ban on revenge porn, which basically just means, you know, in their terms of services, that they have the discretion to choose. They may choose to remove a link to revenge porn from somebody's search engine results. But it's completely at their discretion. And so there's a form, which you can find on my website, deep in Google, where you can request removal. But even from your search engine results, but that's not going to remove it from the URL where it's actually posted. For that to be removed, you'd actually have to contact that website and, you know, either just make a sort of bleeding heart request that they remove the picture. And if it's a revenge porn website, they're probably not going to be very motivated to do so. Or you can claim that, you know, if you own the copyright of the picture, if it's a selfie, you can claim that. A lot of our clients, their pictures first appear on porn sites like Pornhub, which has billions of monthly viewers. And so when a site goes up somewhere like that, just because of the sheer volume of visitors to those sites, they tend to go viral very quickly. And so the removal process is much lengthier because any single person who viewed the image could theoretically download it and then repost it, even if we got it taken down from one place, it can then kind of pop up somewhere else. It depends on how quickly you've become aware of the picture and how quickly you take action.
Or the video.
Or it's been spread.
Right.
Or the video, yes.
Carrie, have you noticed a difference in the last few years with heightened awareness of mistreatment of women from the Me Too movement and other news developments? Have you noticed a difference in the courtroom in terms of judges and attorneys' sensitivity and awareness of the scope of this problem? Or is it getting easier for your clients?
Nothing's easy for my clients. There's still a lot of bias that, you know, suggests that if they're getting legal, if they're pursuing justice, then they must be gold digging or opportunists or pawns in, you know, somebody's Me Too legal agenda, or, you know, man haters, and so there's always that bias to overcome. I've been in court more and more, and particularly in our criminal cases, where the courts are the judges, and so far they've always been male, who've done this, have gone on lengthy screeds against the offenders during sentencing, where our clients have delivered really passionate victim impact statements about what they've endured. And then after that, the judges have given pretty severe sentences and expressed just absolute outrage at the arrogance that the offenders have shown. Because almost always they say, oh, I deeply regret having done this. If I could, you know, it was a mistake. And most of the stalking cases that we deal with, and those are the ones that I'm talking about here, it's so many repeated actions, you know, over a course of time. And so to say that it was a mistake, oh, I fell on my computer 10,000 times and sent revenge porn and made these impersonating accounts claiming that my victim's a child pornographer. You know, like, the judges aren't buying it, that this conduct is possibly a mistake. If there's regret, they regret getting caught.
Carrie, we just have a few minutes remaining. I want to say that your book is hard-hitting and really a page-turner. There's a story about a client where I believe the ex had other individuals commit criminal acts against him that was quite horrifying. How do you deal day in, day out with this kind of case and maintain, you know, a healthy mental attitude about it?
Thank you for asking that. Every day is a different kind of emotional roller coaster, but it helps to have an amazing staff. So I've got now a staff of 13. I'm not dealing with this on my own, and neither are my staff members, and so we can all support each other. I believe a lot in just surrounding yourself by beauty. And I've got a beautiful office, and we've got good-smelling candles and a nice view. And, you know, and I think exercise can be a really great healing, energizing tool. So a lot of just the way of handling this kind of boils down to just support and aesthetics, you know, having comfortable furniture and flowers in the office. Good snacks.
Because let's face it, you are dealing with individuals who have been quite literally traumatized.
Yeah, I agree. And it sounds like it would be very heavy to be dealing with that day in and day out. But we're also solving problems. And so there's a little bit of an emotional removal that comes with looking at the problem analytically and thinking, okay, I know how to solve this. And you can still be very, you know, have great deep emotional relationship with your client and yet have some distance. And for me, there's a lot of just joy in knowing how I can solve somebody's hell. We have our marching orders, okay? Somebody's being stalked. We need to go through the evidence. We need to identify, you know, what IP information we need, or figure out the court. You know, there's so many just like tasks that have to be done, and that can be a very like organizing way to handle things emotionally too.
I want to read before we close a brief review of your book. One reviewer said, in her decade as a victim's rights lawyer, Carrie Goldberg has seen it all. A man who made fake bomb threats in his ex-girlfriend's name, a 15-year-old who was sexually assaulted at school and suspended when she reported the crime, a man who used a dating app to send 1,200 men to his ex's home. The resulting book details how to take control and protect yourself. And the reviews are just all glowing. Congratulations on this magnificent book, Nobody's Victim. Is it out in bookstores now, Carrie?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a question?
Yes.
It is out in bookstores now. It released in U.S. bookstores yesterday on August 13th. And U.K. and internationally tomorrow.
Fabulous. So by the time this airs, it will be out everywhere. The publisher is Plume Books.
I would recommend this book highly to anyone who is concerned about what I think is an epidemic.
Yes, and I would recommend it to people who, you know, have kids that are in high school and college. I think it's a really important tool for them to stay safe and to stay aware. I think awareness is the number one thing that we can, you know, teach our children, and empathy to both sons and daughters. You know, if people understand what victims are going through, I think they're less likely to victimize and less likely to victim blame.
And also to not be filled with shame if you are the victim of this.
Completely. And the whole point is to transfer the shame from the victim to the offender.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, if anyone can inspire others to do this, it is you. We want to thank you so much for your amazing work and congratulate you again on your book.
Thank you. It's such a privilege to be on Law and Disorder, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.